Let's talk about the cornerstones of recovery. Welcome to the Therapy Brothers podcast.
I'm Brandon.
I'm Tyler.
We're brothers.
We're therapists.
And we know recovery.
Bring your stories, your questions, your successes with real recovery.
Hey, Tyler, you ready to have some hard conversations?
Let's do it.
Let the Therapy Brothers podcast begin.
What's going on, you guys? Tyler, your wandering therapist here. I am alone today. Brandon is out sick. He can barely talk right now, so he apologizes for not being here. Hopefully, he starts feeling better. In the meantime, we'll get to some really good discussion today. We're going to kind of get back into some of the basics of recovery. I was telling Brandon the other day that it feels like sometimes we've been doing the show for so long that we get a lot of the same kinds of topics, but then we go to other topics and the new topics. And sometimes we forget that there's the basics as well that we need to continue to reinforce. So we're going to spend some time on the basics. Before I do that, I just wanted to mention and remind you that the Radiant Dawn Conference is coming up probably within the next couple of months now. This is our yearly women's retreat that we do. This is an event that is like nothing else. It's built for deep connection. It's built for deep emotional, spiritual healing. It's not just a recovery retreat in the sense that it's just going to help you with your betrayal trauma. It's more of a retreat that's focused on the recovery of your heart, your identity. And if you're interested, take a look, radiantdawn.org. Go there, see what it's all about. If you're on the fence and you're thinking about coming, you won't regret it if you pull the trigger. So that's in St. George, Utah. It's a great experience. It's something that we've put a lot of work and effort and energy into, and it's something that we really believe in because we've seen and felt, and I can't iterate enough, can't even put into words, the feelings that have come from so many of the women that have attended and the way that it's shifted their life and helped them. So today I wanted to talk to you. I had this idea of just wanted to mention some of the core basic principles that are at the core or at the bottom, the bedrock, so to speak, of a solid recovery, both from sexual addiction, but also from betrayal trauma. These principles apply to both sides. And they're things that seem to be basic, but they need to be reinforced over and over again, and they need to be tuned up because they're an ongoing, living, breathing set of principles rather than a one-time kind of a thing. And so I wanted to spend my time with you today talking through those things. In essence, these four things that we're going to talk about today would be, you know, basically, if you were coming to therapy with me and you had checked in and said, hey, this is our situation, we just found out, we just had D-Day, or I've got a sexual addiction, I need to start working my recovery. Over the course of the next two or three sessions, this is the kind of basic information that I would be giving you in two or three therapy sessions. So this episode is the equivalent of the information or the education that would come in. It's standard for the first two or three therapy sessions if you were coming to see me. So these four things, they're tools that we're going to talk about, but more importantly, there's principles that apply to these tools that are even more important than the tool themselves. The tool is only as good as the principle it reinforces, and I want to talk with you a little bit about the principles behind these tools and why they're so important as you're growing into a lifestyle of recovery. And again, I want to reiterate a lifestyle of recovery because this isn't about one-time thing, hurry, get better, and then let your life go back to what it was because your life wasn't what you want it to be when you weren't in recovery in the first place. This is about the reclamation of a wholehearted life, a life that's vibrant and colorful, something you look forward to, something that's a constant work in progress. So the first one we're going to talk about today, we actually mentioned this in a couple of episodes, so I won't spend a ton of time on it. Because we spent a whole episode talking about this with the daily charge. But the first concept is this idea of dailies. What dailies are is establishing the habit of cultivating the best parts of yourself on a regular basis. In other words, you're going on a quest every day to have an emotional experience with the best parts of yourself. And if you do that on a regular basis, again, it's not about perfection. It's not about being perfect every day. It's committing to doing them every day and checking in on them regularly so that you're cultivating your heart. And what the dailies do is they do a couple of things. One is they actually fill your tank emotionally, and that allows you to have a larger buffer with the life stresses that come up in your life from day to day. So if I have something in my reserves to give when I have a disagreement with my boss, or I have a fight with my wife, or I feel a trigger that I want to go act out with, I can draw from that reserve, and it actually helps strengthen my ability to have willpower and to give good responses. Everybody knows that when we're on empty emotionally, our responses, it's like our nerve endings emotionally, they get frayed and ragged and raw. And then that extra like rawness actually makes us less likely to be wise-minded in the way that we respond to people. So what we're doing with our dailies, one of the principles we're doing with our dailies is we are filling our tank emotionally so that we can use that energy towards the other things that are going to inevitably come up in our day. No matter what we do, we're going to have emotional experiences in our day, and we can draw from the things that we've put in to help get ourselves through that day. So that's the most basic part of the daily. The bigger part to me is the cultivation of the actual heart. It's that I'm getting used to and embracing this idea that I have power to do something to cultivate my own heart. And when I do that, I am doing a behavioral affirmation that I'm worth taking care of. So, you know, we talk about doing affirmations in the mirror, looking yourself in the eye. We do a lot of that kind of work, and I believe in that stuff too. But to me, the dailies is the day in, day out, little actions that you take. And every time you intentionally choose to do something towards connecting with the best parts of yourself, you are reinforcing the belief that you're worthy of being taken care of and taking care of yourself. And that belief is a key core element of a long-term, happy, wholehearted recovery. It's the thing that moves you from running away from all of these problems, all of your demons, and it starts to fuel this idea of that you're running towards something. You're actually pursuing something now because you're worthy of pursuing something. You deserve to have a good life. You deserve to have a rich life. You deserve to know that you're a good person, and the dailies reinforce that. The trick to the dailies is this. People hear this all the time and they go, okay, I need to make a checklist. I need to make a checklist of the five things that I'm going to do every day. That's not exactly what dailies are, but it does include intention. So I'm going to intentionally do some things today, and hopefully the things that I choose are going to be the things that help keep my life in balance, or the things that are going to give me the most bang for my buck. Some of those might become daily checklist kinds of things, but it's not about the checklist in order to stay sober. It's not about the checklist in order to get over your betrayal. It's about engaging intentionally in the things that take care of yourself. So I'll give you an example of some of the basics that I use. We talked about the daily charge. That's connection with other people, hobbies, attunement or mindfulness, rest, proper sleep and relaxation, wrestling with God, and developing and cultivating a relationship with something bigger than yourself. And then the last one is exercise. And those are the basics. We call that the daily charge. But you can include anything else that you want, if it fits under that umbrella or not, as long as it's the intentional pursuit of the best experience with your own heart. So my typical morning looks something like this, and this is something that I actually have come to really value over the course of my own recovery. And it's not always the exact same every day, but right now this is the routine. I wake up early in the morning. I get up around 5:15 in the morning. I go to the gym, and while I go to the gym, I listen to something, often something spiritual, whether that's like a talk by one of my church leaders or it's the scriptures themselves. And then when I get to the gym, I actually turn on something different, usually some kind of a podcast, self-improvement or therapy oriented, while I work out. And I work out at the gym, then I get in the sauna, and then I go home and I do breath work for about anywhere from 5 to 15 minutes. of just simple breath work. And then I take a cold bath for anywhere from 3 to 10 minutes. And that's my typical routine on most days. Now, add that into, on an occasion, some days I also get the chance to go for a little extended hike up into the mountains. That's something that I love. It reinvigorates me. It recharges me. It connects me to God. It gives me exercise. Spending that time with my dog in the mountains is also something that's really beneficial to me. I don't get to do that every day at an extended period of time, but that gets built in along with other hobbies like my fly fishing or maybe some act of service for somebody else. But the basics are there, and the basics work for me because they are the right kinds of things to cultivate my heart. And I could change them on any given day, but I'm intentionally pursuing those things for those reasons. So that's the first thing, the first cornerstone. So if you're thinking about like building a building, you usually start with the cornerstones, which are like the foundation of the building that you're building. So the first cornerstone there is dailies for the sake of cultivating your heart, filling your emotional tank, and reminding yourself that you're worthy of being taken care of. So the second cornerstone is something we call lines of defense. So if you think of dailies, you know, your daily charge is like your offense. Your lines of defense are establishing a good defense. So looking at your patterns, looking at your behaviors that aren't necessarily helpful for you, you identify the core behaviors that aren't working for you, and then you map out what leads to those behaviors, and you establish a line that you will not cross in that pattern in order to interrupt that pattern and then replace it with something new. So I picture it like a big, like you're on the top of a big flat hill, and then it dips off the side, like off of a cliff, and then down at the bottom, you have all of these behaviors that you don't want to do. And this could be for both the addiction or the sort of like the trauma cycle that you find yourself in after you've been traumatized. Oftentimes after trauma, we actually have coping mechanisms come up inside of us that aren't actually all that adaptive after the initial trauma, but we continue to go to them, and then they actually contribute to us getting stuck. So for instance, an example of this would be, you know, if I have something that threatens my well-being, I go into fight, flight, or freeze, right? That's just natural, can't stop that. That's something that just goes on inside of my body. Now, afterwards, the actual threat is gone, but the triggers still remain. And I find myself doing things, for instance, maybe with my partner, I've been betrayed. And of course, I got angry when I found out about that because anger is a protective emotion. And now I'm into it 3 or 4 months. The behavior has stopped. But every time I get in a little bit of a discussion with my partner, I tend to default back into the attack mode of the fight response, where I'm calling names or I'm blaming or I'm interrogating. And it's being done in order to try to create what feels like safety, but it's not actually really helping my overall well-being, and it's not helping the relationship to move forward the way that I would want it to, because I'm acting outside of my values. So I might set a line of defense or a bottom line around that idea that I'm not going to call names anymore. Well, what's the pattern that leads me to calling names? Well, when this trigger happens, or I don't take care of myself in these ways, I'm more prone to end up doing this behavior. So I'm going to set my bottom line, not just at the behavior itself, which is great to set it there, like I'm not going to call names anymore, but also, hey, I'm going to actually, if I feel my emotions getting to a point of, you know, I like to rate my emotions on a scale of 0 to 10. If my emotions are at a 7 or higher, I'm not going to have a conversation with my partner right now. I'm going to go and do some self-care instead. I'm going to reach out to somebody else on my team. I'm going to flush that through so that I don't end up just following the same default pattern of getting into a fight with my partner and calling them names. Because at the end of the day, I don't like how I feel about myself when I default to those behaviors, right? Same thing is true maybe on the addiction side of things. It's a little almost easier to find those things. So I'll give you a couple personal examples with this lines of defense. Early on in my recovery, I sat down and I thought to myself, I wanted to map this out. What are the factors that are always there? What are the factors that are always in play when I act out? because it feels like there's no rhyme or reason to it, but there's actually, when you sit down and think about it, there's actual real pattern and there's a real habit loop for most of us. And what I realized is that on the times that I did act out, the common factors were that I was always alone when I was on the internet. And I didn't act out every time that happened, but every time I acted out, those two things were in play, right? And then I started to map out my patterns a little further, and I realized that I often did this slow play thing with myself where I would stay up late, wait for my wife to go to bed so that I could be alone on the computer, and then I would actually do something legitimate, like do some work or finish a homework assignment or something else. And then after I had completed that work or that task or that homework, I would celebrate by taking a break, and I would check my email, and then I'd check social media, and then I'd go from social media over to YouTube, and then YouTube, I'd watch some stupid videos or other interesting videos, but then the sidebar would always, you know, that endless scrolling sidebar, eventually something triggering would pop up on that, and then I would finally click on that triggering thing. And then as soon as I clicked on that triggering thing, then I would say, oh, I've already messed up. And then I'd jump over to all the other places that I would act out with pornography. Every one of those behaviors is something that we called a ritual, because my brain actually starts to get smart to it and says, oh, when you're alone on the internet and you're going to places like social media or YouTube, it's almost like the primer for the brain that cues it up that says, I'm going there. That's where I'm going to go. I'm going to go act out again. And so it builds the anticipation and it builds the cycle. So for my own personal bottom lines, there were a couple right off the bat that I felt like I had to do if I was being honest with myself. The first thing that I realized is that if I was never alone when I was on the internet, I would never act out. So my first bottom line was that I would never be alone on the internet, period. This was tough because when I started to create these things, I was like fresh into the very end of grad school, working on my thesis. It was a real sacrifice to have to find a way to be in a public space, go to the library in a public open air place to do my homework. I would only really do things on the computer that were sort of business oriented because otherwise it was just downtime and I wanted to be alone with it anyway. So my first bottom line was, I'm never going to be alone on the computer or on the internet. And then I realized for myself that if I was honest with myself, if I had the internet on my phone, that I would cheat with that. And then that would be my downfall. So I actually took the internet off my phone. And then the other couple ones that went along with that is that I got rid of all my social media for a period of time. And I didn't watch YouTube for a couple of years. The reason for that is because, you know, YouTube's not a problem. Like YouTube is actually something that I use every single day. I use it with my group sometimes. I use it for my benefit. I use it for a lot of my learning now. But at the time, the habit loop was so ingrained that even when I saw that insignia, it would light me up with like, oh, I know where this is going. So I needed some time and space away. I like the scripture that says, you know, when I was a child, I did all these things as a child. But when I became a man, I put away the childish things. I realized that I had trained myself to use the internet like a child. And I needed time and space away from it, the way that I had been using it, to then come back and develop the habits like a man so that I could use it for the tool and the benefit that it was, rather than let the habit loop continue to flush me through the way it had for years and years and years. So think about your bottom lines. What is your pattern? And what is the thing even before the behavior you're trying to stop that you can set your line around? And here's the key to bottom lines. Two things. You have to set them with enough sort of like specificity that you can't loophole them, but broadness that it covers what you need it to. And you need accountability. And this is a key element, because the brain is funny how in the way that it works. I set an intention to have a certain bottom line. I'm not going to get on the internet alone, period. And then I'm at work one day and I forget, and I check my email because I'm looking for an email from my boss or something. I've now crossed my bottom line. It's not a problem. I mean, I didn't act out or anything, but because I set the intention, I am now going to live with the integrity to hold myself accountable until it becomes the new habit loop. So I'm going to call somebody on my team and I'm going to reset my bottom line, not to punish myself, not to shame myself, but to remind myself that I have set a new intention. And now the key to this is that it reinforces certain principles of recovery. And here's the core principles of recovery that bottom lines or lines of defense cover. One is that I have to be honest with myself. I need to take a look at my patterns, and I have to be the one to set the intention and be honest with myself about what actually is going to work. And that's important because we like to live in denial. So now I get a chance to practice being honest with myself. If I don't get it right, I'll come back to the drawing board and I'll reset my bottom lines until I get them right. I might even have to adjust them even further back if I keep failing the way that I've been failing, right? So the first one is that I need to be honest with myself. Second is that it cultivates humility. And humility is this willingness to accept all of the goodness that I have and all my strengths at the same time that I can accept that I have certain weaknesses and I'm willing to go to work on those things. So my bottom lines are an outward gesture of that willingness, of humility. So I'm strengthening my integrity. I'm strengthening my humility. I'm also strengthening my ability to connect with others because a good bottom line always includes me building an accountability for my behaviors. So every time I run into a bottom line or I want to cross a bottom line or accidentally step over a bottom line, it will be reset by talking it through with somebody on my team. So I've got honesty, humility, connection, and along with that connection, the fourth principle is accountability. So that one tool, your lines of defense, is actually reinforcing four core principles of a really healthy, really solid, wholehearted recovery. And you can take that skill of like lines of defense or bottom lines, and you can, over time, you'll continue to apply that skill to the next target and the next target and the next target. So right now it might be about my sobriety. But after I get my sobriety nailed down and I know that I'm going really solid in my sobriety, I'm going to take that same skill and say, what's the next target? Oh, I want to stop drinking soda. Oh, I want to temper my video games. Oh, I want to temper my spending. Oh, you know what? The way that I eat now is not very healthy. Oh, you know what? Like I tend to check out and get on my phone when I'm around my kids and I want to be more engaged with my kids. You'll start to up your game to the next behavior and you'll start to get rid of all of the things that aren't serving you. A little at a time, one step at a time, and you'll create new space in your life for the things that actually matter. So that's what lines of defense are, and they're a valuable tool that gets talked about a lot, but then it's almost like it gets talked about so much that people don't even want to give it credence anymore, when in reality, it's a lifetime tool that you will use as you continue to grow. So the third principle or the third cornerstone here is the importance of engaging in a process of continually building and nurturing a team. So all of us are wired for attachment connection. We need it. We do better when we're making changes if we have it. If we have other people in our lives, and the key elements of a good team member, and we'll talk about how to find a good team member here in just a second, is that with a good team member, you need someone who's going to be able to provide a couple of different things. In our practice, we talk a lot about dialectics, where, you know, there's two things that seem at odds with each other, but both of them have truth in them. And one of the primary dialectics that we work from in our practice here is that every client who comes in the door is doing the best they can, the best they know how, and they need to do better. Otherwise, they wouldn't be coming in the door. So what that means is that a therapist, we have to balance acceptance, meeting someone exactly right where they're at, with a push for change. And a good team member is able to balance acceptance, love, compassion, empathy, with a push for change, accountability, clarity. And if you get that inside of a good team member, you're in really good shape, because that's how we change the best. That's how we get the right kind of support that we need. So I can't tell you how valuable this one is and how often this is maybe one of the places where, you know, I'll have someone go through treatment and they'll do everything. I mean, they'll do everything. They'll get these four cornerstones going and then they'll build in on top of that, all the assignments that we give out. And then they start building in these new healthy habits for their life. They get all the way done with treatment and they're done. They leave, they're doing great. And then I bump into them, you know, 3, 4, 5 years down the road, or I get a phone call 3, 4, 5 years down the road. And it's like, hey, Tyler, like, I got to come in and see you again. I was doing so good, but then things started to slip and I've kind of gone back to my old ways and I've been relapsing for quite a while now. And when I sit down with those people, more often than not, I start breaking down where did their recovery start to break down at after so much success. And many times, in fact, most times in this kind of a scenario, one of the gaping holes in their recovery is that after they left treatment, where they had the structure of a therapist and they had the structure of a group and the team that they had built with their group, they had let those relationships sort of filter out, because that's what happens. You know, we have people move in and out of our lives all the time, and they didn't take it to heart to continually cultivate new relationships that could be in that inner circle where I could have acceptance and a push for change. So any given time in our lives, we need to have two or three people in our lives who we are in what I call the inner circle, where they can provide acceptance and a push for change, and they know everything that I'm working on. I look at my relationships as this ongoing, I call it the relationship funnel, where people way up at the top are, you know, the clerk at Walmart or the person at the gym or whatever else. And then it narrows down to maybe some acquaintances, people you see regularly. And then it narrows down to people you're friendly with, but not really close with. And then it narrows down to your closest friends. And then it narrows down to your best friends. And if out of your best friends, maybe two or three are in your inner circle. We have to be cultivating relationships at all levels of that funnel at any given time in our lives, because people will move in and out and up and down that funnel, depending on how often we see them, depending on our value systems, depending on how much time we spend with them, depending on how much time we want to invest in those relationships. And if we learn to do that as a way of life, then you always have that landing space with a few people in your inner circle. But if you don't do that, you go through all this work, you come and you get a group and you build a team and you build some deep intimacy with these people that you're like doing recovery with because you're going through hell together. And then you leave and you don't nurture the relationships and you let it wane. And then you're left all alone again. And it's only a matter of time until you either have to build new relationships or you're going to find yourself going to other places to cope with your stress. And of course, those old places often include the places that you didn't want to go back to. So building a team is vitally important. Now, how do you find a good team? Here's some criteria that I use for what a good team member entails. Number one, will this person that I'm bringing into my team, will they actually like be willing to learn about the things that I'm going through and the things that I'm trying to do so that they can be educated and have a conversation where they can speak the same language that I'm learning? And that's the benefit of going to a group or a 12-step meeting or a therapist is you're going to learn a common language and you're going to speak common principles. But anybody who's willing to do that learning is already a possibility for being included as a potential team member, right? So the second thing is, will this person keep my confidences? If I'm wanting to bring them down the funnel into that those lower levels or the inner circle, part of what allows them to be in the inner circle is that they have a good vault. They can hold the information that I'm going to give them, and they're not going to go spread it all over the place. I see a lot of damage done here on this one, because there's so many relationships that so many of us have that, except for this thing, a person would make a great team member. They're good at listening. They're good at pushing for change. They're good at acceptance. You feel supported by them. And so you go out on a limb and you share all of this stuff with them, only to find out that the next time you go to church or the next time you go to a family party, everybody else at the family party except for you knows the information that you gave this person. And then it erodes trust and it leads to undue and unhealthy vulnerability. So vulnerability is a great thing. Vulnerability is a necessary thing for a wholehearted life and recovery, but vulnerability in the right ways to the right places is a great thing. It doesn't mean you have to go share everything to the whole world. And so if you have people that can't hold it, then that sort of exempts them from being the potential of being a good team member. So the third part of finding a good team member is what we talked about earlier. Will this person try to balance acceptance, listening, understanding, validation, while also being willing to have the backbone to say, have you thought of this? Or, hey, maybe this is your issue and not that other person's issue. Or it sounds like maybe you're keeping yourself stuck in the victim role right now, and you sure could be free if there was a way to move through that and past that. And if you get someone who's willing to do both of those things, they are a gift. And one way that you'll know that is if you feel loved by them, but you also sometimes are annoyed by what they say, it's worth listening to what might be the truth in what they're saying. If you feel judged by them and it's only judgment, that's a different thing because you're not feeling like they actually have your best interest in mind and they haven't really cultivated the relationship to be able to push. So the more trust there is in a relationship, the more I feel supported, the more I feel understood, the more I feel validated, the more I will take from the person that has me feeling supported and validated in terms of the way of a push for change. So someone who's willing to build the friendship and the intimacy so that they can use that to also help you grow makes a really great teammate. And then the last kind of criteria that I make for my inner circle is at the end of the day, I place this as a premium in my own life. I'm biased towards this principle, is that choice and agency is our greatest gift. And anyone who tries to coerce us away from our need to take accountability, to choose, to act with intention, is not a good team member. Anyone who's manipulating us for their benefit or because of their values, rather than allowing me to use my agency so that I can learn and can grow, is not going to be able to sustain themselves in my inner circle. So they need to be able to respect my ability to choose. So if I decide, I go to them and I say, hey, I've got this situation. What do you think? And they give me all this advice. And I go, thanks a lot. I appreciate that. I'm going to think about that. I find the truth here. I find the truth here. I find the truth here. But I also think I'm still going to go do this choice. I want someone in my inner circle to say, okay, I disagree with you, but yeah, that's your choice. You asked for my opinion. Have at it. I'm not going to take it personal. Let me know how it works out for you. Because they value your choice too. They know that you're going to learn as you choose, even if they don't fully agree with what you're going to choose. So those four things make a good team member. And if you have those things, it's worth taking a risk and being vulnerable and continuing to build relationship through shared experience, through time together, through intimate kinds of discussions, and eventually being vulnerable to let them hold that space with you and for you. So the fourth cornerstone here that we're going to talk about, and I think this is one of the most valuable things in all of my own personal recovery that I've learned and that I've continued to try to cultivate. It's been just an absolute game changer, just a complete gift. And it's understanding and engaging in the principles of mindfulness. Mindfulness is an interesting thing. People think of it, you know, you hear the word, it's been really popular. A lot of people still get these images or ideas in their brains of like a Buddhist monk sitting in a monastery somewhere meditating. That's one form of mindfulness practice or being mindful, but it's really about a set of principles. And what the set of principles boils down to is, can I be a deciding being on where I put my awareness and then make choices based off of where I put my awareness and let go of judgment? Can I live life on life's terms without judging it as good or bad? Can I make choices based off of the reality that I'm in and try to be effective for who I want to be? So mindfulness is about paying attention to, is paying attention without judgment and fully engaging in the life that's in front of you. And of course, there's formal practices that you can engage in to help strengthen these muscles, this idea of being aware and present. You know, that's where things like meditation, breath work, imagery exercises, things like yoga, a lot of these things are, they're built to strengthen the muscles of mindfulness. But anything can become a mindful experience as long as it's engaged in with full presence and awareness and complete engagement without judgment. So, and we're judgmental people. We should do a whole episode sometime on mindfulness, but noticing judgment and then removing judgment is also mindful. So if I'm driving home today from work and I see somebody in the car next to me and they drive by me really fast and cut me off, and I'm like, oh, that guy's a jerk. That's autopilot. That happens. That probably happened to half of you driving home today or yesterday, right? The mindful person says, I just called someone a jerk. That's a judgment. What do I mean by that? And what removing judgment does is it forces me back into owning my experience. So instead of saying, oh, that person is a jerk, I have to say, ah, I'm feeling annoyed because I got cut off in traffic and I was feeling the urge to get home and I was a little bit threatened by the fact that I almost got my front end ripped off, my bumper ripped off. So I'm feeling some anxiety, I'm feeling some anger, I'm feeling some frustration because this person cut me off in traffic. Now, if that person is just a jerk, I don't have to do any of that work that the mindfulness affords me to go, okay, I'm in a moment of discomfort. I'm in a moment of anxiety and frustration, regardless of whether or not that person should or shouldn't have. It happened. What do I want to do with my anger and my frustration? And you can see how powerful this principle is when it comes to managing triggers from trauma or urges to act out, because now I'm going into myself and realizing I'm the one who gets a chance to make the choices about the reality of whatever I'm thinking or feeling or whatever is right in front of me. So I now, because of my awareness, get a chance to make a choice. So I can either allow that person to then rule my drive home and ruin the next 15 minutes while I drive home so I can go home and walk through the door and tell my wife what a victim I was. Or I can go into myself and say, hey, it's happened. That guy might even be more in a hurry than me. Maybe there's an emergency going on at home for him. I don't know if it is or isn't true, but if I choose to believe that, I suffer less, right? Maybe I can take some deep breaths. Maybe I can calm my heart rate down. Maybe I can soften the muscles in my face. Maybe I can keep my middle finger from raising itself up as I drive by. Like, whatever that is, like, I'm the one who now gets a chance to choose what's going to be most effective for me, for my overall state of well-being in the reality that I'm in. And there's power in that. Mindfulness gives back the power of choice. It gives back the power of accountability. And in doing so, this is the beautiful thing about mindfulness, is that it has this weird way of increasing the moments of pleasure when you're in them, because you're fully present and you're in them and you're noticing them and you're grateful for them and you're not worried about, oh, is this thing going to last or whatever else it is. I'm just going to be here experiencing it. At the same time, that it also has a tendency to decrease the moments of pain and suffering, because it brings you back to the fact that you get a chance to choose how you want to see it and what you want to do with it. So it gives you a chance to take back control and power in your life, even in moments of pain and suffering. And so it diminishes the suffering that we put on ourselves because of the judgment that we add to it, to the things that go on in our lives. So those four foundational building blocks, if they're continually practiced, if they're continually cultivated, doing your dailies or pursuing your daily charge, setting up lines of defense or bottom lines, building a team, and engaging in regular mindfulness practice and cultivation, those are the foundational building blocks, because they have you connecting with people. They have you pursuing humility, accountability, honesty, connection, and they're reinforcing the principles of a life that's worth living, a life that starts to go from being grayscale or muted or dark or numb to a place where life becomes colorful and rich and vibrant, even though it doesn't take away some of the day-to-day problems of life. It just means you can accept all of the richness and vibrance of everything that's coming because you can trust yourself to manage it when it comes. So hopefully this is helpful for you. Again, your dailies, bottom lines, build a team, cultivate mindfulness, and then recycle those over and over again until they become part of the day-to-day habits of your lives. Once those things are set and you're now managing them and tuning them up and cultivating them, you have a wide base to start pursuing the next challenges in your recovery, whether that's relational healing or whether that's moving through trauma or whether that's overcoming some of your other demons. You now have tools and skills that you can fall back on, which makes the work so much better and so much easier. So hopefully this is helpful for you. Love to hear your comments on it. Love to get your feedback on it. If this stirs something inside of you, go to therapybros.com and sign up to become a call on the show or submit a question through writing. We're always happy to have your participation. And thank you for being with us. And until next time, keep on keeping on.